Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
In 1990, when Jeff Titus had briefly become a suspect in the double homicide at the Fulton State game area, he'd had three alibi witnesses: Gerald and Eloise Shepherd, the couple who owned the farm where Jeff had gone hunting, and Stan Driscoll, who Jeff had been hunting with. All three had been able to place him 27 miles away from the scene of the crime. But the Shepherds had been an older couple even then. By the time of Jeff Titus's trial in 2002, Eloise was 83, and her husband Gerald was 89. They were in declining health, and it was unclear how much longer they'd be around to give any statements that might be material to Jeff's defense. So, in the hopes of preserving some sort of statement from the Shepherds before it became too late, Jeff Titus's friends Stan Driscoll and Larry Crandall had gotten a video camera and headed out to the Shepherd farm to speak to them.
Gerald, you remember anything about Jeff Titus? You remember Jeff Titus?
Yeah.
Okay. Did Jeff Titus ever hunt here?
Sure.
Okay, who did he hunt with?
Stan.
Who did Jeff hunt with? I can't remember. Who did he hunt with?
Did he hunt with Stan Driscoll?
Who?
Did he hunt with Stan Driscoll? Did he hunt with Stan Driscoll?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
This was one of the most lucid moments from Stan and Larry's interview with the Shepherds. In the grainy home video, Eloise and Gerald sit side by side in old recliners in the living room of their farmhouse. The Shepherds' live-in caretaker and their son both hover protectively nearby, while Larry and Stan try to talk to them about a day, 12 years before, when they had become Jeff Titus's alibi witnesses.
But I remember you going over in this area with a shotgun with just two bead sights. You remember that? Probably not.
Talking about your old shotgun, Gerald.
Huh?
Let's talk about your old shotgun, how you used to like to hunt deer. When you used to deer hunt.
Oh, that old Winchester pump?
Yeah, with bead sights.
The efforts by Stan and Larry to jog Gerald Shepherd's memory was not successful.
Larry Crandall and I filmed that Gerald Shepherd was in advanced dementia by 2002. And his son did not want him to be on the witness stand because on the witness stand, the prosecutors would have torn him to pieces and been very embarrassing because they don't care, whereas the son did. So the defense attorney was very incompetent, did not follow up on any rational way of showing that this was a man who really would not be able to go to the witness stand, and therefore there's some legal thing that would allow, under those circumstances, for this to be taken at face value.
At his trial, Jeff Titus had tried to convince his attorneys to find some way to tell the jury about the Shepherds and the alibi they had once provided him.
See, I was told by my attorney that they had dementia, but he says, I ain't going to call them because they're drooling on themselves and everything else. But I said, okay, well, as long as you call the original detectives who talked to him. But I said, are you going to call the detectives? Yeah, he said, but he never did. Their statement of what happened that day, that I was there and they alibied me and that the detectives signed it saying that they took the statement, that was never really used in my trial.
As the Shepherds were unavailable to testify and the defense attorneys failed to call the original detectives Bruce Wersema and Roy Ballett to testify as to what the Shepherds had told them in 1990, that meant the entirety of Jeff Titus's alibi defense would rest upon the testimony of Stan Driscoll.
I am probably a rather unusual person. I probably, unfortunately, take logic and truth above personal interaction with people. Even people close to me.
People who are innocent do not get to choose their alibi witnesses. And that's unfortunate for Jeff Titus because, given a choice, Stan Driscoll is likely not the alibi witness that any defendant would have picked for themselves. Many who have looked into Jeff's case over the years have come to believe that Jeff Titus's conviction can be explained, at least in part, by the testimony of the man who should have been his alibi. Detective Roy Ballett is one of them.
If you asked him a question, he's got to go three blocks out of his way to come back around the other corner to see if he got an answer right. He's processing things in a different manner.
Are you saying that Stan hurt Jeff's case?
I'm not saying that he hurt it, but I certainly would say that he didn't do it any good at all.
Welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 6 of The State versus Jeff Titus. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of A Non-Story, a New York Times bestseller. And I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Although Roy Ballett was one of the case's two original investigators, it hadn't actually been assigned to him. He'd volunteered to work on it in his spare time to help out Detective Versima, who'd been left to manage this sprawling double homicide investigation all on his own. When Ballett retired from the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department a few years later, the case had still been unsolved.
I retired in 1995. I subsequently learned in 2000 or 2001 through the Kalamazoo Gazette that Jeff Titus had been arrested for the double homicide. I went to the prosecuting attorney in charge of that case, Scott Brower, and asked him to explain to me what they have now that we did not have in 1990. He said it was all circumstantial. I informed him at that time, circumstantial does not get it. You don't have any evidence of any kind that he did do it. And he was hunting in Bedford at the time. His exact statement to me was, we got a small window of about 15 minutes in which we believe we can make a conviction, something to that nature. I told him I did not think he had anything at all in that matter.
Ballett had believed that Titus had been cleared as a suspect for good reason. And at the time, Ballett hadn't understood at all what the prosecutor had meant about there being a 15-minute window that gave them enough room for the conviction. Still, after learning that a jury had in fact found Titus guilty at trial, Ballett's initial reaction had been to assume there must have been something in the case that he had missed.
Subsequently, I read that he had been convicted. At that point, being a former law enforcement officer, I figured somebody had something to find him guilty. About a year later, I was subpoenaed in a civil case and became acquainted with Larry Crandall and Stan Driscoll. Larry Crandall informed me that he had transcripts of all of those cases from Jeff's defense counsel, Bill Fetty. He offered to give me them because I was interested in, I wanted to see what they had. When I went through it, I found out they had nothing. Their circumstantial evidence only is hearsay and innuendos.
Just like in 1990, when he'd volunteered to work on the case while a deputy at the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department, Roy Ballett found himself once again volunteering to work on the case. Only this time, he did so as a private citizen. It was through his advocacy on Jeff Titus's behalf that Roy Ballett first became acquainted with Stan Driscoll, the alibi witness whom he had not interviewed back in 1990.
I kind of dubbed him as the nutty professor at the very beginning of this whole thing, my first encounter with it.
To Roy Ballett, Stan Driscoll's way of answering questions at Jeff Titus's trial had seemed almost like a deliberate sabotage of Titus's case.
When he testified, he was so vague, he couldn't remember the times and various other things. He couldn't tell what happened. It's only one scenario. I stayed at Jeff's house, or I drove to Jeff's house early in the morning. We drove out to Bedford. We hunted Larry Crandall's. We had lunch, coffee, or whatever. We stopped at Shepherd's. We had a cup of coffee, and at 4 o'clock, Jeff and I walked out to go hunting. I heard a shot. I know that Jeff got a deer. We loaded into the back of the truck, and we waved goodbye to the Shepherd's. That's it. You don't have to embellish anything. If it's the truth, you just tell what it is. But he would go off on such wacko tangents.
Stan Driscoll is aware of Ballett's criticisms about how he testified at Jeff Titus's trial. But to Stan, what Ballett says he should have done would have been no different than perjury.
This is the reason Roy Ballett is unhappy with me, because he thinks during the criminal trial I should have remembered more than I did. And my problem is I suspected things, but I was under the impression I was supposed to tell exactly the truth of what I knew was a fact. And I think most people on the witness stand are not quite that, with that level of integrity, maybe. I don't know. I've never been in a witness stand before.
The scenario that Roy Ballett believes Stan should have been able to testify to is consistent with the evidence. But Stan's right. It relies on a few assumptions and inferences, and although they're fairly reasonable ones, it involves details like hearing the gunshot that Stan himself has no precise memory of. And to Stan, being under oath meant he was required to say only those things that he knew with 100% certainty. He would make no inferences and simplify no tales. Not even to make his testimony understandable to the jurors who would decide Jeff's fate.
But you're not going to make something up if you don't recall it, right?
I hope I'm considered to be honest by people. Sometimes it's very uncomfortable because you're supposed to socially lie. I very seldom socially lie. And I certainly don't lie on something like this.
It wasn't Stan Driscoll's honesty that anyone really questioned, but Stan's preoccupation with precision often seems to have a paradoxical effect. He was so precise that he became indecipherable. Though as frustrating a witness as Stan Driscoll may have been for the defense, that frustration was likely shared, at least to some degree, by the prosecution.
The problem I had with this was during when I actually was grilled by the prosecuting office. They said, the way they started out, they said, well, were there many hours that day that you were not with him? And I said, define many hours. Well, a lot of hours, define a lot of hours. Several hours, define several. And they said, well, two or three. I said, well, two and a half, maybe two and a half to two. But they were after something at that point. They weren't trying to find out what I was going to say. They wanted me to say what they wanted me to say. And I wouldn't do that.
How would you describe Stan to someone who's never met him?
A highly educated, super intelligent person. And he always accused me of never introducing him because he always played the devil's advocate. Like, what if this or what if that?
Right.
But no, we got along good. Has a real nice wife. We were good friends and stuff. I'd stay at his house now and then. They come over to our house and stay. Sometimes she'd come over and go hunting.
Stan and Jeff came from very different backgrounds, but they had a few things in common. Hunting being the primary one, but they also shared something else. Both were considered by many who knew them to be polarizing figures.
There was people he could get along with, and there was other people that they didn't like him. And a lot of my friends did not like him. He always talked with those $25,000 words, if you want to call it that. if he used big words where a small word would do it.
Although Jeff knew his other friends didn't much care for Stan, and Stan knew there were lots of people who likewise didn't care for Jeff, it doesn't seem as if either of them had been particularly bothered by this.
I know a lot of people didn't like me. I mean, it's just like me and Stan. You know, Stan, he always plays the devil's advocate. Now, see, me, all I ever talked about was my shooting ability, my hunting, my trapping, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but like I say, you know, I consider myself a good shot.
One of Jeff's friends who didn't care for Stan Driscoll was Paul Frederick, who had been Jeff's high school guidance counselor. Paul believes that Stan is a big reason why the police were able to arrest Jeff in the first place.
But Stan said that he told the investigators that he had no idea where Jeff went. What a crock.
Because he didn't see...
He parked just across the road.
But he couldn't physically see him at that moment.
Well, he probably couldn't, but any time I ever go and hunt with anybody, they'd say, where is he? I could say he's in that woods or this woods. I wouldn't say, well, he went home.
He didn't say that he went home. He just said that he didn't see him and couldn't say that he was still there, which...
Yeah, his favorite word is, I definitively can't say that.
Yep.
I definitively...
Had Stan not come down to hunt with Jeff during that opening weekend of deer season in 1990, things might have gone differently at Jeff's trial. For one thing, Jeff might have had an alibi witness.
He's the one I didn't go with him.
So you didn't go?
I was asked not to go.
Oh, that's awkward.
Jeff says, you can go if you want. He says, but Stan doesn't like you. And I say, you know what? I don't like Stan.
Yeah, it seems like, I know Julie hated Stan.
Yes, oh, with a passion.
Julie was Jeff Titus's wife. The ill will between Stan and Julie had been so bad that, although Stan was permitted to stay at the Titus farmhouse during his trips to hunt with Jeff, it was only on the condition that Jeff kept his wife and Stan apart as much as possible.
So it is true that your wife didn't really like him or want him around when...
Nope. She didn't like him at all. She'd be nice if he was there, you know, but as far as if I wasn't there, you know, no. He wasn't coming in.
From reading the letters that Stan wrote to Jeff and others in the case in the 18 years since Jeff was arrested, it's not hard to get a sense of why exactly Julie might have objected to Stan's company. Once, after Jeff's arrest, Stan attempted to extend an olive branch to Julie by writing her a letter that he, in his words, hoped might, quote, ameliorate some of the ill will between us. In the course of this letter, Stan went on to refer to Julie as parochial and stated that, quote, it is my perception that your personality disallowed you to reconsider your attitude towards me as you matured. As you might have guessed, the olive branch was not accepted by Julie. And with Jeff in prison, she and Stan never had to see each other again. In late 2002, not long after Jeff was convicted and sentenced to two life sentences, Julie had initiated divorce proceedings. Shortly after the divorce was finalized, Stan had written to Jeff to offer his sympathy.
Too bad about the divorce. Since Julie has always treated me as a low form of dirt, you appreciate that I cannot offer any objective statements about her. What I can suggest is that when you get out, and if you find a compatible woman, you do not alienate her, as you did Julie, by incessantly conversing about your prowess as a hunter. While you have every right to enjoy and pursue hunting, it behooves you to be aware that the vast majority of the public view your commitment to this sport and the extent of your success with abhorrence. When you're released, it would benefit you to have a heart-to-heart talk with someone like Larry Crandall regarding how people view your extreme focus on hunting, and on deer hunting particularly. With this pontification, I cease offering unsolicited advice.
The friendship between Stan and Jeff had once been straightforward and centered around their shared love of hunting. But their once uncomplicated relationship had become very complicated following Jeff's arrest, trial, and imprisonment.
When's the last time you talked to Jeff?
It's been a very long time because I believe he has taken Ballot's perception of me and sort of turned off his contact with me. I wrote him a Christmas note or something. He didn't respond. Of course, he apparently is not responding to anybody anymore. He doesn't write letters to Crandall either. And he used to write letters to Crandall. He used to write letters to me. I have a great amount of correspondence with him in the first two or three years of his imprisonment. It's really, I was writing him every few days.
Stan is not being paranoid here. He's not wrong about Ballot's dislike of him. And although the two of them had cooperated for a time on Jeff Titus's case, they hadn't made an effective team.
I don't know in what way Stan Driscoll's mind works. It's on a different frequency somewhere. But I know that some of the things that he has said to me, he tries to psychoanalyze everything that happens to the detriment of whoever he's talking to. And that's why I've told him, this is several years ago, I don't want to hear from you. Don't call me again. Don't even suggest that Jeff Titus might have done this. Even question me as to whether or not I think he might have been able to. I said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, among other expletives that I used to him. And I haven't heard anything from him.
During the cold case investigation, Stan had been willing to entertain theories of Jeff Titus's guilt, something which did not sit well with Jeff's friends and family. And even Detectives Worsam and Ballot have expressed varying degrees of exasperation over Stan's willingness to explore hypotheticals about whether Jeff could be guilty.
The more you bring up to Stan, it's like, ooh, maybe. Yeah, he could have left, I guess. Gee, well. But come on, Stan, does that make sense? You know, doesn't really make sense to me, but.
If you really felt this individual was truthful, and that he did not do it, why in God's name would you volunteer to try to tape your hunting partner into a confession of shooting those two people?
In 2001, at the request of the cold case team, Stan had agreed to record a call to Jeff Titus in which he would ask his friend about various subjects related to the murder of the deer hunters. And although Jeff Titus had said nothing on this call that caused any particular damage to his case, for Jeff, that was beside the point.
How did you find out that he was tape recording the call?
I didn't find out until later when my attorney told me.
How did it make you feel?
Anger. Betrayed.
Stan, for his part, does not see his actions as any sort of betrayal, though he understands why Jeff might feel differently.
Yeah, Jeff found out about this. He was very unhappy about it. I don't blame him. I would be too. But I don't defend people simply because I might know them. I defend people if they are worth defending. And I didn't at that point know whether he was worth defending or not. Since then, I've concluded he is definitely worth defending. And I'm trying to do that.
Did it affect your relationship when he found out?
It didn't matter because he was arrested so quickly after that I'd really never seen him.
When the officers asked you if you would be willing to tape a phone call, were you torn about that, Jeff?
No.
No?
No. If Jeff was guilty, I wouldn't be found guilty.
When Stan had agreed to record the call for the cold case team, he had doubts about Jeff's innocence.
How did you feel when you found out? I know you said you had faith that the arrest wouldn't stick. Did you have faith that he'd be found not guilty?
I assumed he'd be found not guilty.
What about more on an emotional and personal level? Here's a guy you've been hunting with for a long time who you feel is not guilty and who's just been convicted of murder.
So from an emotional point of view, I can't respond to that because I do not usually function making my decisions based on emotion. The only person I would do something based on emotion for is my wife, literally. Everybody else I evaluate. I can like them, but I don't do things based on emotion, hardly ever.
But after months of thinking about the case and evaluating both his own memories and the information that was available to him at the time, Stan Driscoll had finally come to the conclusion that the cold case team's theory of the case was not logical. Stan realized that although there were gaps in his memory, certain inferences could be made based on what he did remember. And these inferences were in contradiction with what the cold case investigators were saying had happened. In April 2002, 4 months after Jeff Titus' arrest, Stan placed a phone call to cold case detective Workema to share this important update. But based on the letter that Stan wrote to Workema the following week, the phone call did not seem to have gone the way that Stan expected.
Dear Sergeant Workema, I was chagrined after you hung up on me on Tuesday, April 2nd. After days of contemplation and some queries, my chagrin has changed to notable trepidation regarding what you might represent. Perhaps it is naivete, but I believe my behavior has been to objectively assist the investigation in whatever way possible, even though this was against the express request of Titus. Continuing this pattern of objective assistance, on April 2nd, I communicated that recent thoughts about the events of November 17, 1990 led me to the conclusion that the deer I helped Titus gut that evening had been recently killed. Evidence that could be inculpatory or exculpatory, depending on other evidence you may possess. Had you been functioning as an objective police officer, you presumably would have thanked me, added this information to other information available to the prosecuting attorney, and offered your appraisal of its evidentiary value. Instead, you very angrily called me a yo-yo several times, stated that a person holding a PhD should have greater mental capacities than I possess, and hung up. My trepidation regarding your behavior arises not from your demeaning me personally, but from the fervor with which you definitively declare Jeff Titus to be a murderer. One can only speculate that you are primarily motivated by an underwhelming desire to seek truth and an overwhelming desire to maintain a perfect CCCCAT success record and reap whatever personal benefits this may occasion. I fervently trust this is not reality. But if it is, your activities are socially very dangerous and hopefully represent aberrant police behavior. Respectfully, Stan Driscoll.
Once Stan had reached the tentative conclusion that Jeff Titus had not committed these murders, he seemed to believe it was only a matter of time before Jeff would come home again. Jeff's arrest and incarceration pending trial was unpleasant, but also a temporary state of affairs.
Do you remember how you felt about it?
Not particularly unhappy. I know I didn't like him being arrested, but I believed the legal system would get him released. No, it's a horrible thing to go through, but I at that point believed the system would work.
In the lead up to Jeff's trial, Stan's interactions with the cold case team had made him increasingly wary about their motivations. But overall, it does not seem like he was ever particularly concerned. His letters to Jeff during this time period are almost lighthearted. He expresses curiosity about what it's like to be in jail and concern about whether Jeff has access to adequate medical attention for an injured shoulder. He asks if there are books they can bring at his next visit to help Jeff pass the time, and teases Jeff about whether his snoring is keeping his cellmates awake at night. And he punctuates his sentences with more smiley face emojis than I'm used to seeing from a man in his 60s. Then, in July of 2002, 8 months after Jeff Titus' arrest, the unthinkable happened.
It was only after he was found guilty that I said, ooh, this is wrong. What can be done about it? And then I started doing this investigation and writing up a report that shows why he had to be not guilty. I have to qualify that. There's a difference between being not guilty and being completely innocent. Not guilty, he could have possibly done it, but it's not beyond reasonable doubt. But he didn't do it, even beyond reasonable doubt. He didn't do it, period.
So is he innocent or not guilty?
He did not commit the murders, and it's provable. And I proved it.
Did you guys see this analysis of homicide?
By Stan?
By Stan,
yeah,
this thick?
Sent me that. Yeah, I got that. Well, that wasn't in that.
Beautiful. That guy. something else.
Like a lot of people who've been involved in the Titus case over the years, Detective Rosema had received a copy of this report from Stan Driscoll. Stan first began working on it over 17 years ago now, and he had completed what is now the report's final draft late last year, as he prepared for his interview with the documentary team.
Now, I just went out and got a copy of the report I did based on this, plus the police records. And the title of it is An Analysis of Homicides in the Fulton Game Area, Fulton, Michigan, on November 17th, 1990. I distilled all of this, plus the police reports, and I came up with an analysis that takes 60 pages.
The Analysis of Homicides in the Fulton Game Area is a dense web of citations, charts, diagrams, and results from Stan's various experiments on purported crime scene conditions.
No, this is not a pleasant read. This is terribly turgid.
If you're inclined to skip out in the report and would prefer something with more pictures, well, don't worry. Stan has you covered.
I did a rather extensive PowerPoint presentation covering the materials in my analysis.
Stan's PowerPoint is even available on YouTube if you want to check it out. As part of his analysis, Stan also tested the viability of the cold case team's various theories by attempting to recreate events as they had supposedly occurred. He used a camcorder to document these efforts, and for many of these experiments, he was accompanied by Pastor Dave Macaluso, whose church Titus had attended. The most important of these tests had been that of the drive from the Shepherd Farm to Titus's home and back again. This is the route that the cold case team believes Titus drove that night to commit the murders, during the time period that Stan had been hunting in his blind and had not had eyes on Jeff Titus.
There is the Shepherd house. We are in the driveway of the Shepherd property, ready to go out. Now, we have set the, it is now 3:59, and we have set the odometer of the vehicle to zero, and we are ready to drive at 4 o'clock, which is the purported time that Jeff Titus would have left had he made this infamous drive.
To try and recreate the original conditions as closely as possible, Stan and Pastor Macaluso conducted their drive test on the Saturday of that year that fell closest to November 17th. Starting in the Shepherd's driveway, they then drove south through Battle Creek and into Fulton, and pulled up at Titus's farm.
This driveway is the entry into the Titus property. We drive up and park just to the left of that pine tree. Shift a gear, please. Okay, now go just to the top of this grass, and this is the logical place to have stopped, and park the car. We are now ready to depart at the time, about the amount of time we believe it would probably have taken to do all these things that were purported to Jeff Titus. The time is 4:56. It has been just under 1 hour since we left the Shepherd property. We still have the car at, I can't see what it is over
27.2
there.
Miles.
27.2 miles. We will now turn around and head back.
Because there's so little evidence to work from, in attempting to reconstruct the cold case team's theory, Stan's timeline necessarily had to incorporate a number of assumptions to fill in all the gaps. And all the unknown numbers in the alibis equation were given whatever possible value was most unfavorable to Jeff Titus's case.
He had to do some things. He would have decided what to do, load his gun, various things. I give him 3 minutes for that. I'm trying to make this the minimum time in the analysis as possible. I have no idea what it would take. First of all, he didn't do it, but had he done it, it would probably take more than 3 minutes. But in the worst case, give him 3 minutes.
So, for his hypothetical timeline, Stan had given Jeff 3 minutes to prepare for the murders, 3 minutes to walk back to the end of his field to reach the victims, and then 5 minutes to commit the murders themselves. That seemed to Stan like the shortest possible time frame in which Jeff could have actually pulled the murders off. But Titus's property had 80 acres. Even if you assume Jeff would have first tried the 40 acres to the west of 46th Street, which is the portion of the farm that borders the game area, and where Jeff presumably would have started if he was looking for a trespasser to murder, like the cold case team believes, that's still a really large area, and it's covered in fields with tall crops and pockets of forest, and it's not flat.
what he logically would have done had he done this drive, because this field has very interesting characteristics. These ridges here disallow you to see this area from the road. He logically, had he done this, he would not have come in and driven straight across there.
To meet Stan's schedule, which gives Jeff 3 minutes to find Doug after Jeff pulled into his farm, he would have had to have immediately cut across his fields and then beeline to the precise ridge where he could have glimpsed the corner of his property, where, according to the cold case team's theories, the confrontations with Estes ultimately occurred.
The critical thing that the prosecutors did not do is they did not understand the implications of not being able to see into that field. So the question you have is, why would he have gone directly into that area?
Stan's timeline is also favorable to the cold case theory in another way. Under Stan's scenario, no time has been allocated for Jeff Titus to locate the doe the cold case team thinks that he stole from Doug Estes. Instead, it's assumed that Jeff is able to get the doe and load it up in his truck without losing any time at all, as Stan's timeline jumps straight from the murder to Jeff departing his property. From there, it's a 40-minute drive back to Shepherd Farm, where he hopes to arrive before Stan notices that Jeff is gone.
Okay, this is where Driscoll would have been picked up. It is now 5:37, and we traveled a total of how many miles?
54.4, just exactly double.
54.4 miles.
In Stan's recreation of the cold case team scenario, his total round trip time was 1 hour, 37 minutes. So could Jeff Titus have made it to the Fulton State game area and then back again during the time period when Stan was out in his blind and couldn't see him? Well, the case's two original detectives take different positions in that question.
In my opinion, you could not leave Bedford area and get to Fulton State game area and shoot two people and get back within even a 2 hour frame period.
Detective Roy Ballard says the cold case theory timeline is impossible. It couldn't happen. The laws of physics forbid it. But as Detective Racema sees it, the facts here aren't quite as black and white as that.
Given the time frame that we have and a 2 hour time window, yes, it would be possible, could be done, but not probable, in my estimation.
If you assume that Jeff Titus was able to sneak away from the farm at exactly 4 p.m., and if you assume that Jeff Titus committed the crime with maximum efficiency, then yes, in that case, Jeff Titus could have just barely made the trip home and then returned to the Shepherd farm at a time when, if Jeff was lucky, Stan might still have been lingering in the woods and had not yet returned to discover that Jeff was gone. If you assume all that, then like Detective Racema said, it's possible that Jeff Titus did that, but it's highly unlikely. And there was absolutely no evidence that any of that had happened. No evidence, that is, until the cold case team went and talked to Bonnie Huffman.
On the night of the murders, it had been well after dark before Jeff and Stan had made it back to Jeff's farm. Once there, they'd headed back to the fields to gut the doe that Jeff had shot, and then hang it up in the shed to process it. While going back to do this, they'd seen the lights at the back of Jeff's field and realized something was going on.
So that would have been anywhere from 7:20 to 7:40. Somewhere in there is when I got home. And then I went over and saw that stuff and talked to the officer. Then I come back up to the house. We finished dressing out the deer and hung up the deer. Stan took over skinning that. The ambulance had come, and then I turned around and talked to them for a while. Then I went down to Burnsworth to tell them what was going on.
The Burnworths were Jeff Titus's neighbors to the south. Patricia and Bob Burnworth's farmhouse was only about 0.2 miles south of where Titus lived, though the Burnworths were on the opposite side of the road. That evening, Titus says, after finding out about the murders, he'd walked down to the Burnworths' house to let them know about what was going on in the state game area.
So I would have went down there. It would have been after 8 o'clock, closer to 9, that I talked to him, because I talked to the ambulance attendants, and that's when I learned all the other stuff going on and so forth.
Pat Burnworth and Jeff Titus had been friendly with one another. As far as Jeff knew, they got along just fine. After her husband died in the 90s, Jeff would often help out by plowing her driveway after it snowed, and they'd chat sometimes.
She has a daughter, right?
Right.
Bonnie. Did you see Bonnie that night, too?
Nope. I can't remember. She must have. She probably was there.
Okay.
I know he was there, she was there, and I'm pretty sure she might have been.
The Burnworth's daughter, Bonnie Huffman, didn't live with the Burnworths, but she often went to her parents' farm to hunt during deer season. That's actually how Bonnie had become one of the earliest witnesses that investigators spoke to. She had been interviewed by Detective Worsama back in 1990, though the reason Worsama had gone to see her at the time had nothing at all to do with Jeff Titus.
What haunts me is that, through my investigation initially, I had interviewed a person in the vicinity by the name of Huffman, Bonnie. She was visiting her mother in the area not far from the Titus farm and the scene on the Fulton State Game Area. Initially, she told me that she had been hunting on the corner of the property, had heard a vehicle speeding, traveling. Subsequently, she could hear the vehicle had went into a ditch and crashed, and then could hear people talking in that area, discussing whether they needed to be pulled out or what have you. Ms. Huffman had told me that she hadn't seen anything, just heard it.
The record of Worsama's 1990 interview with Bonnie Huffman is brief. Bonnie said she'd been out hunting near the intersection, heard the car go into a ditch, and that she thought the driver's behavior had been suspicious. And that's about all that's written down in Worsama's report. But Worsama says that was not the full extent of what he and Bonnie had talked about during this interview.
Initially, she told me that Jeff had come over in his truck alone, that it was in the evening after dark, well after dark, and she thought it was between 8 and 9 p.m. And she recalls that because she hadn't eaten yet and her mother was preparing dinner, which is not unusual for her mother to prepare late dinners, such as that night. So I had mentioned to her that, you mean like in Europe, European dining, where they eat generally, they'll eat later in the evening. And I had been in the army in Germany prior, and that's the experience that I had. She agreed.
Worsama's memory here about how Bonnie Huffman had told him about Jeff Titus stopping by that evening is not reflected in the typewritten report of his interview. But in the following paragraph, Worsama's report describes how he also spoke to Bonnie Huffman's mother, Patricia Burnworth. And according to the report, Patricia had told Worsama she first heard about the murders at around 8 or 9 p.m. that night, when her neighbor, Jeff Titus, had stopped by and told her about what had happened. And Worsama is adamant that Bonnie Huffman had also told him the exact same thing as her mother.
And that's where we got into the time. That's when I started into, like in Europe, they eat late. That is what really triggers the whole thing. And I know for absolute fact that's how she said it. And there should have been a written statement in there, and that doesn't seem to be in the report. And that really, I just don't get that. Like, there are things missing out of that report as far as I'm concerned.
What Bonnie and Mrs. Burnsworth told Worsama in 1990 about seeing Jeff Titus at around 8 or 9 p.m. that night had matched exactly with what Jeff Titus had also told investigators.
Now, her time on the first report is right. I went down there and told them that there had been a shooting or whatever, and that the police were back there and the ambulance was at my house and so forth. And then after that, when she talked in the cold case, everything changed. And when she testified, it changed and stuff.
After reopening the investigation in early 2000, the cold case team had worked the case for nearly 2 years before they were able to arrest Jeff Titus in December of 2001. During that whole time period, they'd never tried to speak with Bonnie Huffman, although they spoke to her mother multiple times. And then on April 30th, 2002, just a few weeks before Jeff's trial was scheduled to begin, the cold case detectives had shown up at Bonnie Huffman's workplace to interview her.
This is from a report from the cold case team after Bonnie talked to Mike Workema, and another officer, Gwen Romanek. She states that as she was getting to her mother's house, Jeff Titus was pulling into the driveway in a pickup. She stated that he was alone and no one was with him. He went into the house and was there for approximately 30 minutes and had told her and her mother that he had found two dead bodies on his land. She was again asked if he specifically said on his land and that he was the one who found them, and she stated that is what he told them, that he himself had found two dead bodies on his land. She also stated that he had been at another neighbor's house prior to coming to her house, and she felt this was between 6:15 and 6:30 because that was about the time it was getting dark.
In her 2002 interview with the cold case team, Bonnie Huffman told the investigators something that they had never heard before. That on the night of the murders, Jeff Titus had driven up to her parents' house at about 6:15 p.m. that evening.
Bonnie's statement was a big deal for the cold case team. At 6:15 p.m., Jeff Titus should not have been at the Burnworths' farm or anywhere else near Fulton, because Titus's claim is he didn't get back to his farm that night until after 7 p.m. But Bonnie's statement was also a problem for the cold case team. According to Jeff Titus's own timeline of the night, at 6:15 p.m., he'd been driving back home from the Shepherd farm. And this is a part of Jeff's story that Stan Driscoll is able to back up without hesitation. Stan would have been able to testify there was no way that Bonnie Huffman could have seen Jeff Titus at 6:15 p.m. because at 6:15 p.m., he and Jeff had been together in Jeff's truck. Luckily, by the time of Jeff Titus's trial, the cold case team's problem had fixed itself.
This is her trial testimony, okay? The question is, how long or when did you decide to quit your hunt for the day? I roughly say about 5:15 because it was getting dark and it's always darker in the woods.
At what time is she saying?
So she's saying she left the woods around 5:15. Why do you think she keeps changing the times?
I don't know. And I'm surprised that no one caught it.
In Bonnie Huffman's interview with Detective Workema on April 30th, 2002, she'd said that Titus had come by her parents' house that evening at around 6:15 to 6:30 p.m. But 2 months later, on July 10th, when Bonnie testified at Titus's trial, that time changed again. She now said that Jeff came by shortly after 5:15 p.m. that day, which is when she'd stopped hunting for the day and headed back toward her parents' house. But if you've been a juror at Jeff Titus's trial, you would not have known that Bonnie Huffman had changed her story about when she saw Jeff that night, and in fact, had changed it not just once, but twice. Titus's defense attorneys never brought the matter up. They didn't cross Bonnie about either of her prior police statements, nor did they ask her about her mother's statement that Jeff Titus had not shown up at their house until around 8 or 9 p.m. that evening. But Bonnie's story, if believed by the jury, would be a crucial blow to Jeff's defense.
The shots occurred sometime after 3, 4 o'clock, 4:30. That would mean if he visited her before nightfall, that he was in the area and could have been responsible for shooting those people near his property. Very huge. Big.
As Detective Rusima acknowledges, Bonnie Huffman's testimony placed Jeff Titus at the wrong place at the wrong time. If Titus was at the Burnworth farm a bit after 5:15 p.m., then he hadn't stayed at the Shepherd farm like he claimed. This visit to the Burnworths destroys Jeff Titus's alibi. But as Detective Roy Balla points out, this raises questions of its own.
Just killed two people behind his house. Why in God's good name would he drive into his neighbor's driveway and talk to her and tell her that there are two dead bodies back there? The man's got much more common sense than that.
If Jeff is guilty, why would he have sabotaged his own alibi by visiting the Burnworths? Prosecutor Scott Brower had an answer for that. In closing arguments, He argued this had all been part of a clever tactic by Jeff Titus to disguise his role in the murders. Brower told the jury that Titus had just finished committing the crime and was leaving his farm to drive the 27 miles north back to the Shepherd farm when he'd happened to run into Bonnie.
However, as Titus left the area southbound on 46th Street, he was faced with a problem. There was Bonnie Huffman walking to her parents' house. If he could see her, she could see him, and she knew him and his vehicle. So he turned in, spoke with her and with her mother. He fed them a line about finding two dead men, then left.
According to Stan Driscoll, though, there's a logistical problem with the prosecution's theory here about why Titus went to see the Burnworths.
Had he done this crime, when he came out of his residence, he always turned north to get back to where I was. To see Bonnie Huffman, he had to turn south. He would not have turned south when he always would go north is more rational. You know, it makes absolutely no sense.
The cold case team says that Titus took a different route from usual that day. That's all, and he turned south out of his farm instead of north. This meant that he'd been driving past the Burnworth farm just as Bonnie was turning in to go to her parents' house. Titus had been worried that Bonnie had seen him and would remember him driving past and would be able to place him at the scene of the crime. And so, in order to avoid raising Bonnie's suspicions, Titus had pulled into the Burnworth's driveway, followed Bonnie into their house, and told Bonnie and her mother about how he'd just found two bodies on the farm, and that he had not called the police yet to tell them. That way, Titus would seem much less suspicious. According to the prosecutor, Titus's tactical move had been a resounding success, at least for a time anyway. It wasn't until 12 years later that the whole thing fell apart when Bonnie Huffman had learned about Titus's arrest from news reports. That's when she learned for the first time that Titus was claiming he only returned home that night after it was already dark. That, said Prosecutor Brower, had made Bonnie very upset, because she knew it wasn't true. After all, she'd seen Titus that afternoon while it was still daylight out.
Before the cold case team tracked down Bonnie Huffman and heard about her new timeline, there'd been no evidence that Jeff Titus was in the Fulton area at the time the murders occurred. But in some ways, having no evidence actually made things simpler for the prosecutor's case against Titus. After all, when your factual record is pretty much a blank slate, you can fill in those blanks however you want. You can argue that Jeff Titus did whatever he needed to do in order for him to be guilty of this crime. But once the prosecution started adding facts to their blank state, they were also starting to tie their own hands. Now, whatever scenario they came up with to explain Jeff Titus' guilt would also have to be able to take into account Bonnie Huffman's statement. At trial, Bonnie testified she'd given up on a hunting at around 5:15 p.m. that day, which she acknowledged was a very early time to stop hunting. But she was scared of the dark, she said, and so she always quit hunting while there was still daylight out. She had then walked out of the woods and onto the road and headed up north along 46th Street to her parents' place, which is about 4/10 of a mile up the road. Assuming that trip would have taken her about 10 minutes, then, at least according to Bonnie Huffman's story, the absolute earliest that Titus could have followed her into the Burnworth's house is around 5:25 p.m. that night. Bonnie said that he stayed there for a while, too. She initially told the police that Titus had talked to her parents for about half an hour, though by the time of the trial, she'd shaded this down to 20 to 30 minutes. So taking the lower end of that range, that would mean the absolute earliest moment that Jeff Titus could have left the Burnworth farm is 5:45 p.m. That's the same time it turns dark and legal hunting comes to an end. It's also the same time that Stan Driscoll would have left his blind and headed back to meet up with Jeff Titus. At any minute, if he hadn't already, Stan would be walking up to the Shepherd's farmhouse where he expected to find Jeff Titus. But under Bonnie Huffman's timeline, Jeff Titus was still a 40-minute drive away.
By the time Jeff Titus left her home and drove back to Bedford, it would be well after 6 o'clock. It would be dead dark, and the two shepherds and Stan Driscoll would be standing there saying, "Where in the world have you been?"
For cold case Detective Workema, there's another reason, too, that Bonnie's testimony is proof of Titus's guilt. Both Bonnie and her mother, Pat, said that when Titus came by their house that night, he had been alone, that Stan wasn't with him.
So one thing that we heard repeatedly from Workema and from Mike Brown is that your wife would not have let Stan be in the house without you.
She did not like him. She did not like him.
To Detective Workema, that Jeff Titus was by himself when he went over to see the Burnworts on the evening of November 17th could only mean one thing, that when Jeff Titus was out at the Burnworts, Stan had been 27 miles away in his blind at the Shepherd Farm. Had this visit to the Burnworts occurred later that night, after Jeff and Stan had both returned to Titus's farm, then it would have been impossible for Jeff to have visited the Burnworts by himself. His wife Julie would never have allowed it.
So, you know, the cold case team is like, so when you went down to talk to Bonnie Huffman, the fact that Stan wasn't with you is
Stan was in the garage cutting up the deer. He was in the when we got the deer and we dressed it out, brought it up and hung it, he was skinning it out and stuff. Because I wasn't down the Burnsworth's house that long. I just went down, told him what was going on and stuff. Talked for a little bit and they come back.
The animosity between Stan Driscoll and Julie Titus was important to this case in a different way than Detective Workema believes, though, because it was the source, indirectly, of another important piece of evidence in this case. Though, unfortunately for Jeff Titus, it was not discovered until after his trial. Because Stan and Julie didn't get along, whenever Stan came to visit Jeff on hunting trips, the two of them would try to have their meals outside of the house as much as possible, to minimize the time that Julie and Stan had to spend around each other. On days when they'd been hunting at the Crandall and Shepherd Farms, this usually meant grabbing dinner at Burger King on their way back down through Battle Creek. And although much of Stan's memory about the events of November 17th, 1990, is too indistinct to be helpful, there is one event from that evening that Stan can be certain of, that on their way back from the Shepherd Farm that evening, he and Jeff went to Burger King.
We stopped by Burger King, and I called my wife. I called my wife at 6:44 that evening. So I know exactly what we did that evening. At 6:44, we were at Burger King.
Stan can be certain of this fact because he has records that back it up.
My wife is excellent in keeping records and documents and various things, and it did not cross my mind that we had this phone record that I made from the Burger King at 6:44 that night. And for some reason, my wife was digging around and said, oh, here is this record.
That evening on the 17th, after they'd finished hunting at the Shepherd's, Stan had used his phone card to place a call to his wife, to check in and let her know how the hunt had gone.
11-17-90, 6:44, phone to Ypsilanti from Battle Creek, Michigan. This is the phone call from Burger King that was made just after we left Shepherd's that evening.
This calling card record is not as precise as, say, a cell phone record would be. It does not identify the exact phone that Stan made a call on, but what it does show is that Stan's calling card had been used to place a call that night at 6:44 p.m. from a phone in the Battle Creek Exchange area, and that the call lasted 4 minutes. According to both Jeff and Stan, the only place they would have stopped that night after leaving Shepherd Farm was the Burger King.
Can you turn back to that page for a second?
Sure.
And can you tell me this is proof that at 6:44, Jeff was with you at the Burger King in Battle Creek, Michigan?
I can't prove that. What I can say is I couldn't have been there unless I was in his vehicle. I had no vehicle of my own. The only way I could travel around was with him. So that, I suppose, is proof that Jeff was with me at that time because I didn't have my vehicle with me. It was his car, his truck, with the deer in it.
Stan may have had to take 3 left turns around the block before he got to it, but in this calling card record, he was able to find an answer. Everything else that happened that day may be up for debate, but that calling card record provided a fixed and immutable data point. At 6:44 p.m. that night, he and Jeff Titus had been together, and they were in Battle Creek.
And the analysis here is my Sprint card call to my wife at 6:44. This is objective data, and it shows that Titus could not have done what Huffman is claiming to have done.
In some ways, trying to prove or disprove Bonnie Huffman's statements is a fool's errand. She's given so many conflicting descriptions of when she saw Jeff Titus that night that a prosecutor who was motivated to find Jeff Titus guilty could use her to establish basically any timeline he wanted. But the timeline the stand goes off of is based on Bonnie's trial testimony and her statement that when she saw Jeff walk into her parents' house that night, quote, "it was definitely too dark to hunt any longer." Since legal hunting closed at around 5:45, this would imply that the time Bonnie saw Titus had been sometime later when it was noticeably darker. 5:55 p.m. maybe, or 6. Bonnie had also testified that Jeff Titus had stayed there and talked to them for at least 20 minutes. And that would mean that Titus had been there at the Burnworths until at least 6:15 p.m. But if Titus was at the Burnworths until 6:15 p.m., then he and Stan could not have been together at 6:44 p.m., when Stan Driscoll made that phone call to his wife.
I called my wife at 6:44. That's definitive. We have proof of that. At 6:44, Titus had literally just finished talking to Huffman about 20 minutes before. So this definitively proves that Huffman's scenario makes absolutely no sense. The result of this is Jeff E. Titus is in prison for life. He's in prison for life. That made me emotional. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I don't normally do that. Done.
Why did that make you emotional?
I have no idea, but it made me emotional. You know, just, I guess, going through the fact that it is so obvious he didn't commit this crime, and he's been in prison for 20 years because of it. I guess it hit me because I see you people paying attention to this. Nobody else paid attention to it. And that's probably what made me emotional. I'm not usually emotional. Okay, done.
Been a long day.
And that was weird on my part. Okay.
Stan Driscoll died a few months after this interview. His death was unexpected, but peaceful. He collapsed one evening while at home with his wife and could not be revived. Shortly before his death, though, Stan had written to Jeff Titus once again. It was the first communication between them in several years. His letter began,
"Jeff, during the 18 years since your conviction, I have extended what I call tough friendship. By this, I mean I have never criticized your behavior related to the events following November 1990. Tough friendship also means I have not engaged in the sympathetic conversations over the unjustness of your being incarcerated that I expect is common with your other contacts. My interactions with you have instead been efforts to assist in your exoneration for crimes you did not commit."
Stan's letter was harsh, but also hopeful. For Stan, it was the hopefulness that was the more uncharacteristic part of the letter. He'd written it after his interview with the Red Marble documentary team, and he'd come to believe that maybe, this time, there really might be some momentum behind Jeff's case. And maybe, this time, something might come of it. Inspired by this hopefulness, Stan had lots of advice that he believed it was very important for him to tell Jeff immediately, so that Jeff could take advantage of the opportunity and maximize his chances of winning his freedom. Stan's advice was things like the following.
"My final observations on your behavior relates to your inability to understand how others perceive you. Your trial attorney, Ward McDonough, told me you were a very difficult client, since all you would do was say, 'I didn't do it.' While you were on the witness stand during the civil trial, I commented to Pomeroy, 'You were telling a hunting story and not offering a defense. In any future public appearance, you should avoid looking guilty. During the evidentiary hearing, you slouched in your chair and did not communicate with the people representing you. Quite candidly, you look guilty as hell.'"
In reading through Stan's last communications to Jeff, I can see the hopefulness and even excitement that he had. And although Stan's delivery may have left a lot to be desired, it's hard to disagree with a lot of the suggestions he was making. But to Jeff, what had stood out about Stan's letter was the harshness.
How did that make you feel?
I didn't make me feel good, but like I say, I'm just, and I don't know, how am I going to say this? I'm a little upset, but like I say, both of our feelings are hurt.
Jeff did not respond to Stan's last letter, though he'd had no way of knowing at the time that it was the last. That's all for episode 6 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. There's an addendum episode this Thursday, so don't forget to send us your questions with the hashtag UDAddendum, and we'll be back next Monday with episode 7. Amit Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. Music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Don Logus, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Eric Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, and on all social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.